Welcome to actually, this is a special edition for our Overcoming Long Haul and Chronic Fatigue. Today, I have with me Jamie Kunkel. Dr. Kunkel is a doctor who's been working with us for the last year and a half and has just brought his wisdom and expertise to our clinic, and we've really been, it's been a joy to have. And we're going to talk about our experience with long COVID. And first of all, Jamie, tell us a little bit about you and your prior experience.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I've really enjoyed working with all the docs and the patient, this population at Gordon Medical. I've been practicing for about a decade now. I went to Pasteur University in Washington State, and I also did a master's in Chinese medicine and acupuncture, traditional Chinese medicine system. So I kind of started out there. I did my undergrad in neuroscience. I've always had a lot of, you know, interest in that arena as well. But about, you know, 6, 7 years ago, I started working more with complex chronic diseases, and I was part of a integrative practice there. So I was kind of doing a little bit of everything, Eastern medicine and Western medicine and all this kind of thing. And so that was kind of where I really started, you know, coming into my own, I think, to where I am now. And it's been, you know, a journey, but it's been a great one. And, you know, my interests really are to try to unravel these complex cases, to try to really figure out where the imbalances are within the individual. It's a multi-systemic process typically. So I'm kind of going through all that with these folks, and really just trying to give them hope, trying to give them answers, and getting on that journey and toward healing.
Yeah.
So that's really what it's about. So I'll talk more about my practice as we go, but that's kind of the long and the short of it.
Right. You know, and, you know, what's so fascinating is how, long haul has been just another teacher of the complexity of people and meeting and our immune systems meeting a new bug, but with old patterns. And that's what's been, I think, so interesting, is the, you know, how often the patterns are the same, but the triggers different. It's been a real lesson.
Yeah, we had a great foundation coming into this, and certainly there are nuances to it. I mean, it's a novel virus with novel, you know, processes, and some of them might have already been going on in other illnesses. We just, you know, didn't think about them or know about them in the same way. And it's been a pretty amazing teacher for us, for better or for worse. And I'm hoping it will greatly enhance our practice in the long term, and there'll be more research and money and all the good stuff going toward having answers to some of these things.
Yeah. So when you, so at this point, you know, you've got, I think of long COVID patients in several groups. You know, one of them has been, you know, the people who thought they were really healthy, you know, before COVID. You know, and you might, so what's been your, so let's start off with that group. What have you seen in that patient group? Because those would be people who really called us because they had long COVID, not because they had other problems.
Correct. Yeah. So one population of patients that I have seen with long COVID have been the ones that are previously healthy, and they've been referred to our clinic by, you know, Dr. Patterson's clinic or somebody else. And a lot of them, if you really dig deep, they may have had some stuff. It wasn't manifesting strongly. A few of them, you know, I had one guy that told me he had some occasional fatigue, relapsing symptoms of some sort that would come and go. And some people chalk it up to, oh yeah, you know, I'm getting older or something like this going on. And some people didn't really have anything notable. But I consider that sort of the pre-healthy population, and COVID comes on the scene and suddenly they dysregulate. And what's within that, maybe it was there before, maybe it just was regulated, you know, infections and toxins and all this stuff we'll dive into. But that population is really interesting. They can heal quicker sometimes, which is great, sometimes with minimal support. And you know, we don't have to necessarily follow them for 2 years. It might be a couple months or 6 months or at the most or something like this. And that's a great population to work with sometimes. And occasionally that the trigger will really dysregulate this population. And it happens sometimes and they become more like our complex chronic patients. But it has been my experience that that hasn't been the majority of that group.
Yeah, that and out of them, I mean, because we were talking earlier, we've seen responses to basically almost all different kinds of therapies. Any one of them stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've used some of the very basic supportive therapies like the FLCCC program, for example. Some of my classic foundational support naturopathic therapies and, you know, this kind of thing. And beyond that, I started off using Patterson's protocol, Dr. Bruce Patterson's protocol a little bit from more of the drug model and kind of integrating the FLCC and more of the natural based approach with the drug model together. And a lot of that was working okay. Not to say everything was working great, but some of it was working. It just, there seemed to be enough synergy between those two systems that population was responding okay. And a few of them that didn't respond, we would just kind of rethink our situation, figure out what we were missing. Maybe there was more of a mast cell issue going on, mast cell activation issue or something like this, which we'll talk about. Maybe it was just something we didn't immediately see when they were coming in. And oftentimes they were coming in with the expectation, if they're coming from Patterson, of getting a base protocol. And maybe, you know, we would sort of enact it and we would put our own flavor into it if it wasn't working. But yeah, that stuff was working okay for those pre-healthy people, I think, for the most part.
And I think that's something that, you know, I just want everybody to understand is that, you know, each one of these protocols has its strengths and weaknesses, and there are people who they'll work for. I don't think any of them are bogus or not real. It's just finding out what the individual is going to respond to. And, you know, I think at this point, you know, we don't tend to start right off with the drugs. We're usually looking for more just supportive things, because support and time will help a lot. It just depends on how severe the symptoms are, you know. So you're, in the more complex group, you know, so the ones, I mean, because I said I had that same experience in the beginning with the referrals from Dr. Patterson's, you know, testing. It was, you know, people came in and they wanted their Maraviroc and their statin, or some of them did. Some of them were still afraid of those, but the ones who did, you know, and so fine. And then what's next? So where have you tended to go with those populations? I mean, you mentioned the mast cell thing to look at, but where else have you been poking underneath the hood?
Yeah, for sure. I think that I've been looking very intently at infections and what, I guess, you know, Patterson's group has acknowledged that to some extent as well. And of course, infections are a big deal in a lot of, you know, a lot of dysregulation in the body and a lot of complex chronic cases. Of course, infectious disease does come up. And so what's come in with COVID, possibly there were co-infections, and then what was reactivated from COVID, maybe dormant viruses or even bacteria sometimes that are, or fungus, fungal elements that were within their system. I have a patient that had a major issue with candida. We actually found it too. We cultured it. We found PCR evidence of it, you know. So infections are a very big deal in a lot of these people, I've come to realize. And toxins, you know, two things that usually dysregulate people, toxins are the next big thing. So some of them have had, say, mold in their environment prior, you know, they've worked maybe occupationally in toxic places. And that seemed to be another layer that I had to kind of, you know, investigate or get into a little bit further, because I kind of came back to that general principle of like COVID and the spike protein and all this stuff is causing some sort of inflammation in the blood and the endothelium and the walls of the vascular system, or causing these other secondary activations in the platelet systems or all that kind of stuff. What else is acting there, or what else could be causing a problem there? And, you know, our blood's not sterile. We have infections that float around there occasionally, some of the viral stuff, and, you know, there may be other stuff too. So I would look at some of the tick-borne infections in some of these people sometimes, and I'd find some evidence there. Maybe they had pre-existing Lyme or something of that nature. And a lot of viruses, you know, it seems like a lot of these cases look like chronic fatigue syndrome, classic chronic fatigue, and there's often viral stuff that's there. So infections were a very big deal. Toxins were a big deal. Mast cell activation was a big deal. I always look at the endocrine system and see if something's funky there. And occasionally I have found that stuff does dysregulate there as well. Their hormones may drop significantly. I've had women that are perimenopausal go menopausal for a while. They just, you know, everything stops for a period of time. I'll go through the adrenal access, the thyroid access, the, you know, everything all the way up to the insulin systems and the metabolics, and really do a fine combing of the endocrine system, because that's usually a really big deal too. And then of course there can be autoimmune triggers coming from the infection, from other things. Occasionally people will develop autoimmune disease. I have a patient that developed Sjogren's from repetitive hits of COVID. So yeah, I'll kind of go through and see what I'm missing, really. And I'm usually missing something if they're not getting better. And there's even more that I'll probably talk about, but that's kind of the
I think it's something that you know, the endocrine and all the various endocrine pathways, you know, people often just think of, like, you know, the adrenals and the thyroid, but, you know, we have to remember the insulin system is really part of that world. And that, whether it was, and in America, welcome to a dysregulated insulin blood sugar system is often there, you know, and we know that predisposes to severe COVID. And I don't think anybody's really looked at how much, that's a very good, how much it might predispose to long COVID, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's something that shows up enough. I mean, there's patterns there. I definitely see insulin resistance. I see higher levels of insulin. I see blood sugar dysregulation. I see pre-post, before COVID, after COVID, those things worsen. I think there is some literature on the worsening of blood sugar regulation after COVID. You'll see that with a lot of other chronic syndromes as well. But there seems to be a connection point there. And that's where I went back to, like, what affects the blood again, too. The cardiovascular disease is also a predisposing factor, whatever that means, in that system. So it probably goes even further and deeper into the world of genetics and other, I've already mentioned, epigenetic factors that affect the metabolic systems that sort of predispose. And you're just seeing COVID sort of trigger that system, too. And so that working with that system is usually important, because if you just let it continually dysregulate, it's hard. But you can't make them go and just exercise right away if they're having the classic symptoms. So you have to kind of be delicate about it, I think, in how you approach it. But
you know, because I said, good. But the point I always make over and over again on these talks is that inflammation is the problem, and fixing it is the solution. And, you know, everything gets dysregulated. Dysregulated, you know, as we say, you know, the higher, you know, inflammation creates different survival needs for the body. And what we have to do is get the body to be not inflamed. And sometimes we do it by getting rid of the bug or getting rid of the toxin. And sometimes we got to convince the body just to stop the inflammation for a while to figure out that the danger is gone. You know, it's this dance back and forth with the system. But what I love is how, you know, like how you lay it out, that we just really have to keep our eyes open. You know, I mean, one of the most frustrating things for patients is they come and they start a therapy and, you know, and it doesn't work, you know, and it's like, wait a minute, I should be better. I did this and it didn't work. And I think, and one of the things we've been trying to bring out to people is by showing that we had, you know, by having the talks with people who focus on different body systems, you know, or different theories of COVID or long COVID, that, and what I like about in our talks is how you clearly see that all of them can be playing, or only some of them are playing, but you always have to keep your eyes open. Because you don't know which ones are playing in the person in front of you. And that's why I always want people to know that there's hope, because this illness seems to have a solution. I mean, like, in all the people we've seen, nothing's 100%, but people, over time, people get better. I hope it's more than just time, considering what we're asking people to do. I do believe it's that, because most of the ones that a lot of them we're seeing now have been waiting for a year to get better, and it still hasn't happened. So the
sure. fact that no, I think it is more than time. I mean, some of them are quite stuck, and there's something missing. And if you find out what that is, I think they start to move again. There's momentum again forward. So yeah. I do think time does help some of these people, but it really just depends on where where the stuckness really lies within their system. Yeah. It's hard to shut off some of these things once they start.
So do you have some cases that kind of show different stuck points that might be interesting?
For sure. Yeah, I have several.
Let's talk about a few of them.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one of them that was really tough, well, I guess I should preface by saying that the ones that are the toughest seem to be the ones that have more neurologic manifestations in my experience. And that can mean a lot of things, but they often have some sort of neurologic disease it comes out that way in some capacity. And that could be many different things. They may have neuropathies of different sorts, or they may have obviously immense fatigue and brain fog of different sorts and things like this. And it can be anything to what looks like, autoimmune manifestations in their nervous system. So I haven't been able to, figure that one out. But I have a case that was involving kind of a COVID and a possible vaccine injury of the mRNA, the COVID, at the same time. And that one kind of developed a lot of neuroinflammation, nervous system inflammation. And we worked through a lot of the very basic protocols with this person and didn't really get a ton of gains until I found out that there was a lot of infection with her. As I started working with the infections more intently, I started to see more gains in a good way.
What type of infections were you seeing?
Oh, yeah. So this person had several. She had been treated prior for tick-borne infection and supposedly was better. And some of that stuff started to come back. So we found Lyme, Bartonella. We found there was viruses and stuff, lots of viruses, Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus. I see those combinations oftentimes in the neurologic syndromes, as you often see with chronic fatigue too. They really hit the nervous system from different angles. And occasionally I've also seen Babesia in some of these people, which is really interesting because that puts the fatigue to like another level in some of these people. Not great. So anyway, I treated these, and then this person still, I think, has a lingering infection. So I've made a lot of progress treating the infections. And now I'm kind of finally figuring out, I think, maybe what's left from that. But the only movement I've had from this individual person was really with the infection specifically. And you have to even go deeper sometimes than what's on the surface of even that conversation. And so I think we've found that this person probably has some variety of really highly resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae. And that's where we're kind of shifting our focus to. So this was kind of one of my harder neurologic cases, I'd have to say. And I probably have some other examples I can share, but this one is clearly a infection-driven case. I guess I should say that there's probably some heavy metals and some other, toxic elements, but the infections were really the hardest part for this particular person. So that's one case that was very stuck. Some of the other ones I'm still unraveling, I have to say, but I have probably a few other examples I could say. I keep bringing up infection because I honestly think that some of my hardest cases that were the most stuck, that was the best thing I found for them, was something that we could really focus on. And that seemed to push them forward. So that was really cool. And as I said, sometimes it's also, mast cell. Let me check my little list and my little cheat sheet here.
Yeah. To recap, it makes sense that, since COVID COVID gets in and creates havoc initially because of its ability to transiently suppress the innate immune system, and that seems to like have this downward spiral on the T cells and B cells, but mostly the T cells. So it's not a surprise that latent infections start cropping up, when your whole policing system gets a little dysregulated.
Yeah, totally. And I think my other case, I'm still trying to figure out. It's very hard to treat this guy because he has really severe neurologic disease. He gets like tremors and jolts and all kinds of different things, and just really severe anxiety, which anxiety comes up a lot with these people too. They get crippling anxiety, and they can't really completely control it either. It's not that it's just that they probably are stressed and anxious about their illness, but there seems to be more of a physiologic driver to the anxiety response. And so this guy, he must have had, I don't know, 7 or 8 tick-borne infections prior. He used to live on the East Coast and had a bunch of tick bites earlier on. And then it wasn't until he kind of got the dual smackdown from COVID and the COVID vaccine, actually, that all this stuff just sort of woke up. And it was challenging to treat pretty much any of it. Like the mast cell, we had to use very micro doses of things to try to push it forward. And even with the infections, we had to use little doses of herbs and maybe a little bit of pharmaceutical antibiotics and stuff like that. So that's been a slow progress, but we can make progress even with those most sensitive of patients. We just have to really step back and kind of creatively orient their treatment to how sensitive that they become on multiple levels. And those are some of the more difficult spectrums as well, but there is hope for those too. You just have to be, you have to have a practitioner that's really listens to you, hears you, and is very intent on personalizing this whole formula for you. And sometimes it is compounding or micro dosing different things and kind of moving it along, but you have to gain momentum somehow. You can't just stop and sort of be like, okay, we can't do anything for you. So that was another one of my really hard neurologic cases. I am making progress on him, but it's you know, probably another cycle, another year probably before I can say
but you're bringing up the super, you know, like the really sensitive, you know, with people with a strong, with at least some mast cell component. And it's not always mast cells. There are other immune cells that can be, yes, have a very hot trigger. Mast cells are the flavor of the month, as we say. But, you know, just the immune system and the detox ability are all, you know, so sensitive. And I think that's what I love what you're saying. It's just so people can understand that this is almost like I call a game of pickup sticks. You got to go very gentle, be very light, and, you know, really pay attention to what's on the inside, what the patient's sharing, and which it sounds like and that's allows for the work that you do to happen. And that's,
yeah, you really got to meet people where they are with any of this work, I think, in general, but especially when, you know, these are people that have prior been not sensitive. They've been sort of tanks in this world. Like they've been able to do everything that everybody else is able to do, and now they can't. So, you know, you really got to be sort of gentle with these people too, because that's another thing that's probably driving a lot of their stress and anxiety response, is that, you know, suddenly why isn't my body regulating? Why isn't it doing what it used to be able to do? So you just gotta be gentle, and you can't force any protocols on people. And even if you think something is going to really work, it may not, or they may not be into it or accepting of it on multiple levels. So yeah, it's another issue. So yeah, the sensitive,
you always have to have another option.
You absolutely do. Or another practitioner you can refer to, even. I mean, you don't have to do everything. If you think somebody else is better for it, you know, send them over there too. But that's why we need more people, because we don't have enough.
So you've got, you know, so you got, you know, so you're neuro, so as you say, the neurologic people often have, you know, a layer of infection, and, you know, I mean, the mycotoxins are, I would be high up in my,
they often do have a history there too. And my one patient also had post-explant, what was considered breast implant illness on top of all of it. So I think that probably triggered some things too. So yeah, and like I said, heavy metals, once again, affecting the blood, affecting the brain. Certainly look at them, look for them, probably other pieces there. But yeah, mycotoxins are a big one. I'd say that the top two that are hidden that people miss all the time are probably the infections. Some of them are not always obvious. like I said, Club's Yellow.
Yeah.
Are you screening for that every day? I mean, maybe we should. We just find it sometimes. That's it. And then the other one is the mycotoxins are a big deal there.
Right. And yeah, we see a lot with the neurologic. And as far as any patterns that you see with the muscles, people with more musculoskeletal complaints or things of that sort, is you ha- I mean I personally haven't noticed big differences. People seem to have the whole all the pictures, but some of the research suggests that there are like buckets, you know, of like musculoskeletal people and brain fog people, and I'm blocking on what the third bucket is. I seem to see kind of a mush.
Yeah, me too. I don't know if I've had just straight, I guess I've had a few people that have developed joint pain specifically. That's kind of an interesting one, but it's not like a common factor. I'd say usually they have kind of that mix and mash, sort of that fibromyalgia type presentation. They might just have more, you know, myalgic symptoms or something like this, or they do have more intensive pain episodes in various parts of their body too, so you know, just their response to pain is different. But it kind of feels like it manifests a little bit more like a fibro picture whenever I think about it. As far as insights there, I mean, I always look at the viral stuff first with some of those people, as I often had, and you know, I'll kind of try to screen a little bit of the autoimmune undertones, as I've mentioned, because occasionally if it's like really in their joints and it's really inflamed and, you know, funky, that could really be what's going on with them. And I've had a fair share of people that have developed or worsened their pre-existing autoimmunity where they haven't had any history of it whatsoever and suddenly they have it. So we do have to, you know, be careful, I think, with that arena too, just, you know, make sure you don't miss that sometimes. But yeah, other than that, with musculoskeletal, as I said, it's like, I agree with you. It's kind of like a mix and mash. They usually have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And then they also seem to have this. And that may not be their biggest concern if they also have really severe brain fog or, you know, really other stuff. So it isn't always like the first primary concern that's presented to me as well.
Yeah.
It's usually kind of more of like, oh, and I also feel terribly achy. And I'm like, yeah, my joints get funky too. Like they get very stiff and painful and stuff like this.
Yeah, I must admit my bias for persistent and joint pain that's moving around the body is going to be the tick-borne diseases or mycoplasma, chlamydia.
I mean, migrating joint pain.
Yeah. That seems to be, you know, I mean, even if autoimmune disease is there, I still, you know, I think we both agree that, you know, if you treat the underlying infection, you got a better shot at quieting the noise.
That's absolutely true. And I start there. I don't usually jump higher than that. The infection's the present. It's got to be done, even if it's manifesting like autoimmunity. And that's, goes back to my infection discussion once again.
Yeah. Infection. You know.
So much Lyme in these people. There is a lot of Lyme or Borrelia, whatever, these Borrelia species of different sorts. I mean, name them. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them, obviously, but they do seem to come up quite a bit in these cases.
I think this is because, you know, I think back and, now our practice is so much people with chronic disease, but I remember like 15, 20 years ago, and we used to see a lot more people with, relatively new Lyme, like they didn't know what was wrong with them. And they were coming into just because they were fatigued for the last year. And at that point, when we first found Lyme, they often wanted their whole family checked, which is a good idea at the best at any time. But what always amazed me is how it's just like mold, you know, that everybody's living in the same environment and only one person has the symptoms. You know, we would see, one or two people in the family with Lyme symptoms, but the three or four other members of the family had, more impressive looking Lyme tests.
Yeah, totally. Maybe their system was handling it, but
And I think that's what people, I don't think the population, I know doctors don't understand this, that it's not just that people clear Lyme. I think lots of times people just keep it under wraps and they don't have symptoms and they're doing fine, but you hit them. But when COVID comes and disrupts the immune system just a bit, or sometimes a lot, you know, then that expression, that bug is kind of begins to reproduce, and then your immune system has something else to jump up and down about, you know.
Right. Yeah, totally. No, I would agree. And I think that's just it. A lot of people do regulate these things. You know, they can get multiple tick bites and not be sick, but throw COVID into the mix or throw something else into the mix. I mean, they used to say even some people that would get high doses of steroids would get reactivations of Lyme that was not otherwise known. So anytime you really hit the immune system down, there's a chance for that to happen. So whether you talk about the viruses or whether you talk about Borrelia, but a lot of us do carry these things. Bartonella is a big controversy too, for the same reasons that a lot of people do carry it. They've had cats or they've had animals in their life and they've had exposures. So maybe it is there somewhere, but is it causing a big problem with everybody? Not everybody. So yeah, so COVID really does unmask some of these things for people. And it's a little scary for them sometimes because they're like, I didn't know I had all this. There's a lot of stigma around that. And there's obviously a lot of controversies with Lyme disease as it stands too. So it doesn't help matters that we don't have a lot of acceptance and understanding of these dynamics, just kind of on a, you know, conventional or mainstream level. It's just not there. So that conversation gets a little hard sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's very important for people to understand, is that most infectious disease doctors do not believe that there is anything except acute Lyme disease. And after that, if you've had 3 weeks of antibiotic therapy, or 6 weeks, depending on the person, on the definition, you have something called post-Lyme disease, and that they feel is autoimmune. And so when they start seeing these positive antibody tests or T-cell tests after COVID, they're not going to believe them, especially if they're going to see a lot of positive IgM, which they believe are false positives. So we're in a world of, and this is what really makes this is a heartbreak. I mean, like all chronic illnesses are really heartbreaking because they just get in the way of life. You know, people, you know, chronic, I mean, acute illness gets in your way, but you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month, you're back, you know, life goes on. But these things come in and hang out and can really be are terribly disruptive. And then the fact that medicine, that we're in such areas of disagreement, is and people not respecting this idea of chronic persistent low-grade infection, you know, it only applies to tuberculosis, let's see, hepatitis C, HIV, you know, I mean, the things that we've had good specific tests for, and we can find the bug easily.
That's sure.
Yeah. But
yeah, that's acceptable. But these other ones,
these other ones still haven't made the grade.
No, testing is still limited.
Yeah, hopefully long COVID is gonna slowly change that, because the testing paradigm is going to be different, where they're looking for more subtle signs. So I can only be hopeful. So here you are with you know, you've had a lot of long haul patients. And are there any rules of thumb for when you know, like when people, let's say people are starting out, because like you said, you there are some folks who, you know, you knew, like you've done some supportive things for people, like like if they got COVID or if they were going to plan to get the vaccine. Anything in that area you think has been useful that you found mitigates some of the risks?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes generally to COVID, the virus illness, still treating it early and appropriately, quickly monitoring the patient, understanding what maybe they, if they do harbor other infections or other tendencies, if they do have sensitivity reactions and different things like this, that you can support them up front effectively. And that's very important. I think the people that I've jumped on protocols very quickly with, I always tell them, let me know if you're positive or if you've been exposed. Let's talk about it. And we talk about it, and we jump on to treatment very quickly. And that doesn't always mean pharmaceutical treatments. That can just be vitamin C, zinc, and quercetin, and vitamin D, some of the basics, NAC, N-acetylcysteine, those kind of things at a very minimum level. And if they're higher risk, I will sometimes give them Paxlovid in the first 5 days very quickly. I will give them ivermectin sometimes as well. I've still found ivermectin to help with the inflammation response of COVID and vaccine responses as well. It does seem to help augment the inflammation at the very least. You can debate about the antiviral qualities all day long, but clinically it works quite well in terms of helping to mitigate the intensity of the symptoms. But jumping on the infection quickly is really the key feature, and then monitoring for those post phases, seeing if there is if there are issues with, say, fibrin increases, coagulation issues, clotting, hypercoagulability, very important. If they do have lingering or reactivated respiratory infections, there's a certain group that have a lot of pulmonary symptoms or pulmonary post-COVID pulmonary. Monitoring that and addressing that early is a really big deal, I think, for these people. Monitoring the O2 sats and jumping on things after you're past the first phase of the virus, you can, if you have to use steroids or other really intensive anti-inflammatories for a short time, you can. You don't have to use high doses of them either. Very big deal. So you're just following the patient sort of through the beginning and hopefully the end. And the end is hopefully within a couple of weeks. Some of my really sick people, it might be 4 weeks instead of 2 weeks where they start to feel better again, but not letting up and just following through. And then with the vaccine, it's kind of challenging. First of all, they do have to tell me if they're getting it. Of course, that's helpful usually. I can kind of prepare around it. Oftentimes in those cases, I will use a lot of antioxidants. Once again, I will use a lot of vitamin C. I will use a lot of NAC and stuff like this. And I will use vitamin E, basically all the blood stuff, I'll monitor them appropriately. But if they get triggered from that, sometimes it's not right away, which makes it kind of more challenging. I've had a few patients where it was just the next day and really bad, and it just like flared out their chronic symptoms. I had a patient with stiff person syndrome, SPS, which I think Celine Dion just, announced she had that. So it kind of came to the mainstream. But that person got a vaccine and the first mRNA, Moderna, I believe it was all 2 years of progress that we had made on her illness, just kind of all went backslided and it backslid quite a bit. And it took us another year and a half or so to get her back to where she was before that. But that was very early stages of the vaccine. I didn't have, as good of protocols there, generally speaking. I still can't claim that I can magically stop that process. I think that the surge, just my theory maybe, but the surge of spike that comes from the mRNA is, I think, a little harder to mitigate. You don't have a way to stop viral replication like you do with the infection. You don't have a way to very quickly mitigate. So you're not sure kind of if that surge is going to escalate into something else. But generally speaking, I will think about it from the blood model, once again, really support intently. But I've seen a lot of infections reactivate from the vaccine too. So some of the same sort of things that happen with the virus can happen with the vaccine too, in terms of that suppression of the immune system response or that dysregulation of the immune system response, however you want to characterize it. So in those cases, I look at, very intently at what's different about them. And some of these cases, like I have a family, for example, that had several hits with COVID-19 virus and then a couple hits with, the COVID vaccine series. And it was the booster that kind of pushed them, each of them, weirdly enough. It was like their second booster, I think. And then it was just this past summer, they all got COVID. And ever since then, every one of them, four members of the family, all have different manifestations. One had Lyme since she was 10, she's 40 years old. And now she has crippling anxiety she never had before, for example. Never had that in her whole history. And of course, fatigue and worsening pain and all kinds of things. And then her two sons, who are 12 and 14, one, they have a history of PANS and PANDAS too. One, flared up quite a bit there. And then one is just really, really, really fatigued. The PANS and PANDAS didn't come back, but the fatigue, became very immense. And then dad is the most functional of them, but his fatigue kind of tanked, and a lot of his blood markers, cardiovascular markers, went up really high too, fibrin, lipoproteins, and different things. So it's interesting to see kind of these repetitive hits in some of these people too, and how that looks. So I kind of try to pay attention to how many times they've had COVID and how many times they've been vaccinated on top of it. I feel like if they didn't dysregulate from the first experience, there's still a chance that they could from subsequent experiences. So I try to tell people, you don't have to live in a bubble, but just still, we want to communicate on these types of events and monitor them appropriately to try to prevent them from escalating. Because I still think that if you get on them quickly, there's a chance that you could get them to not go too deep or go too far. So, but a lot of this is really highly individual at the end of the day. That's why I'm kind of speaking in sort of generalities here, I have to admit. But it's really what in that person is going wrong. And these repetitive hits are really very, very personal in how they dysregulate too. So I can't say there's been a silver bullet for all this stuff, just to think about it as a full system once again, and really think about the individual in front of you once again, and really try to figure out where that imbalance is lying with them. But sooner the better.
Yeah.
Sooner the better.
Yeah. I mean, because that is an issue. We haven't really brought that up much in this series, is there were people with repetitive COVID infections, which is coming more common. I mean, we're now 2.5, yeah, almost 3. I can't count years, but we're almost 3 years into this, getting close. And
yeah.
Of course, there are people with now 3, 4, 5, 6, six. And it's... This is where we need the research. This is where we need, I don't know why we don't have data on people's infections. I mean, like, there's got to be something a little bit different about people's immune systems or something who get COVID once than the people who get COVID six times. And, when they're all having the same exposures, I'm not talking about the person who lives at home and hasn't gone out in 2 years,
right,
but
right.
It's just so frustrating, because that's where the answers lie. We need to know who and what we have to do things for, just like the vaccines. It would be so nice to know who the vaccines are going to be, like an annoying sore arm and not even that, and be fine. And it's just going to give them a leg up so they don't get really sick with COVID, and who the vaccine is going to make really sick. And
right.
Maybe they should better just take their chances. I mean, this is, we need data. I keep, this is my plea. I keep saying this. I don't know if the public really needs to hear me say it again, but it's just so frustrating, because as a, as doctors, you and I are working hard to help people. And at this point in California, it's actually, we can say anything we want in public, but it's actually illegal for us to, not illegal, but we can lose our licenses if we told someone in person to not take the vaccine. And, but we see people who are injured by the vaccine. We also see people who have done very well with the vaccines.
Yeah,
and we just need to know who is whom. And it's a plea for that instead of this demand for silence. I mean,
right.
I, anyways, that was a little political thing. I can't help myself. It just came up.
it needs to be said, I think. I mean,
we just need information. As physicians, we are hobbled by the lack of real science and data collection. And now almost 3 years into this, I mean, that, I did speak with Dr. Pelosi from UCSF, who's part of the RECOVER program, which is the government actually spending good money and really doing good research, doing exciting things. But still, it's going to be, the reality is the treatments that come out of that will be, God knows, another year or two away, and they're going to be all rehashes of things that are all, they're not going to be very creative, because they're not going to look at anything creative. But they will give us information, so that will be good.
Yeah, that's really what we need, is information, because really a lot of us are relying on these types of discussions with our colleagues, the anecdotes, the observations, what we've all been seeing. And we're trying to just understand together. None of us know everything, and anybody that would claim to say that they have all the answers, that you can't. You can't. So that's really what we're relying on right now. And we do get little snippets here and there of new studies that are exciting, but yeah, the politics that's come into this has been very difficult, I think, to navigate, because we do see patients that are injured by the vaccine, but we aren't given the opportunity to really see the studies or see more information as to how I could, I don't know how I could predict that with some of these people, but even just to say that we could acknowledge that that's a possible outcome, it should be okay from the doctor-physician relationship to have that discussion and make that choice. Just bypassing that is just, you know, it can injure people. I think that that's what really bothers me the most about it. And this just goes for anything. I think we need to be able to, there's a sanctity between the doctor-patient relationship here. What we understand about the person sitting across from us is way greater than what the broader, you know, public health. And I totally understand public health and where they're coming from, you know, the greater good and all this kind of thing. But with some of these patients, unfortunately, they're the deviation from the mean, or they're the people on the periphery. And sometimes we don't know, we can't predict that. Like I said, they may be previously healthy. So how do we better understand what really makes this tick? We know diabetes or, you know, cardiovascular disease are two triggers or two possible predisposing factors, among others, but we don't know enough. So
and we don't know enough of what's going to make you react to the vaccine, because, you know, again, like you said, but, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes would be things that we'd like to give people the vaccine for, because those people don't do well.
Right.
And I would like to know for sure that, to be fair, probably safer, but we just don't have denominators. Nobody's been collecting the data. And so we're kind of lost. And this is terrible because it's unnecessary. This is what the public health people should be doing. So I don't know why I've been spending so much time thinking about long COVID that it's frustrating because, you know, tick-borne disease is one thing. Nobody really believed in it, you know, chronic fatigue, but this is, we've got millions of people with this. It's been, it was like at least 2 years even public health authorities agreed that this was a problem.
Yeah.
And they're still left us pretty much in the cold. Anyway.
Yeah, because you can go to the big centers and they can run tests on you from all the specialists, and so a lot of the labs can just come out looking normal, but you can still be really sick with this. So there, until we find answers, until we understand more of the nuances of this, we are kind of left a little bit in the dark, because people are still being gaslighted and still being told that they're not sick because all their labs look good and their scans look good. They don't have fibrosis in their lungs, or they don't have, not everybody with post-COVID has some sort of identifiable ailment from what the classic conventional, you know, investigation would provide. So I think that's kind of holding people back too. So I still see a lot of people kind of just being pushed aside despite the wide scale of this. Yes. So, yeah.
No, it's, you know, and we're back to anecdotal medicine, which is what we have to do, because we have to try, because we do see people get better who have been ill for a long time. And that is the goal, and just getting the other doctors out there who have been treating, you know, the functional medicine doctors and the Lyme docs and the mast cell docs and the mold docs, you know, get them all to realize that, okay, look with a wide lens, and people with long haul, you know, deserve your attention, and that kind of evaluation can get you places. And, you know, and to be fair, I think the COVID centers that are academic centers are doing, I said, it's doing a good job if you have autonomic dysregulation usually, but other than that, they're not prepared to offer people non-standard treatments under the guise that we can't be sure it's going to work. And as I said, you know, maybe we should be very careful if we're going to do things that have potential big harms. But most of the things that we do are fairly safe. And I think that's the message over and over again, is keep looking, keep trying, and don't give up. So anyway, I thank you, Jamie. It's been always, we do this a lot without the video. It's fun to talk and just go over patients and really get a feel for, just the complexity of the patient and just how much fun it is to watch another person's mind working through these complexities, because it's always a pleasure to watch yours. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.